So wisdom.
So we're looking at ethics, meditation and wisdom in the context of the mandala. And right at the beginning we talked about, and Dhammadeep has very skillfully and practically helped us with this as well, looked at the mandala in terms of the transformation of our entire life. That's the way Sangharakshita uses the notion of mandala. You place the Buddha, you place the three jewels at the centre of your life, and your life becomes completely transformed in the light of that ideal that you've placed at the centre of your life. So this is, of course, a dynamic process. It's going on all the time. And for some time, it's going to be a process that comes and goes. Sometimes we might feel that we really have done serious work on reorganizing the mandala of life, the mandala of our life. We've, through our effort with our Buddhist practice, sort a lot out. You know, we've perhaps really developed a lot more mindfulness. We've really worked on our ethics. We've developed in meditation. We've developed metta. And yes, we can feel, yeah, the Buddha, he's certainly more central than he used to be, and my life is harmonizing around that. Perhaps you might feel that on a retreat where you go away and you know, on a retreat, the Buddha really is at the center, you know, much more than usual. And everybody in the retreat is striving to make the Buddha at the center of their lives. So you can feel it all coming together, only to find when you go home that it all falls apart. And instead of the mandala, this harmonious world, you've got chaos, certainly in your spiritual life, disintegration. And it can often feel like that. You can even get it together in your usual conditions. You can feel everything sort of flowing in a harmonious whole, maybe for a period of time, only for it to be sort of shaken up, maybe to do with circumstance, maybe to do with the kleshas, you allowing the kleshas to take over your life, the impurities. You know, we seem to go forward and we seem to go back. You know, the mandala gets formed, the mandala breaks up. There's a bit of a cosmos, then there's a chaos, and so on and so forth. That's what it can be like. It can be very frustrating, upsetting, disappointing. And of course, you know, one of the things going on here is dear old Mara. Mara, the embodiment of, if you like, the anti-mandala faction in our consciousness, in life. You know, Mara sees that lotus of, because a lotus flower, sometimes that is described, it's the symbol of the mandala, you know, the unfolding petals. Mara kind of looking, said, oh, there's a little mandala forming down there, so let's just deal with that, you know, and suddenly we're down in the mud, down in the swamps. So it can feel like this, and it's, yes, it can be frustrating, disappointing. Until that is, we develop transcendental wisdom, until we see things as they are, as they really are, until we develop wisdom. When wisdom develops, the formation of the mandala is irreversible. This is quite a thought, that process of making the Buddha completely at the center of our lives, you can't turn back from that. That's going to keep going. That process of transformation won't stop. Might take a very long time. There might be a lot more material to transform in the mandala, but you've reached a sort of tipping point. You've gone over the edge. You've got the one-way ticket, if you like. It's happening. The way Sangharakshita described it on one occasion, trying to describe what's known as stream entry traditionally, it said it's a bit like you've planted the standard in the enemy camp. You know, don't be afraid of the warrior imagery. It's very traditionally Buddhist. You know, the Buddha isn't all flower petals and, you know, soft focus. I mean, the Buddha was a kshatriya. That was his background. He was a warrior. And he's not afraid to use warrior imagery. So you've planted the standard. You've planted, if you like, your shraddha, your faith, your wisdom, right in the enemy camp, right in the heart of the kleshas. But there's still a lot of work to do, a lot of work to do, a lot of purification to do, both within yourself and of course in the world around you. Even if you are sorted, it bothers you that other people aren't sorted. It bothers you that the mandala of life is not sorted. You don't feel in any way complacent. But you have planted something, and that comes about through wisdom. So this is what we really need to aim for. Sangha actually used to say that stream entry is a realistic goal in this life. It's important to aim for irreversibility in this life. But not in a sort of grabbing way and not in a status way. This is quite important, I think. You can't gain stream entry through sort of grabbing it and trying to sort of grab it to you. It can sort of be a bit like that sometimes. People can tell you rather ironically about their insight into, for example, not self. But they seem to be talking about self as another massive self. It's really weird. They're going on about not self, and yet you look at them and there's this ruddy great self, you know, that before you, this great big sort of monstrous sort of ego rabbiting on about not self. Well, you know, that is more to do with status than it is to do with the reality of seeing things as they really are. One of the signs of stream entry is a genuine humility and tremendous faith and receptivity in the Buddha. And maybe even a sense of, well, even sort of surprise and unselfconsciousness about any kind of attainment. It's held extremely lightly and modestly and completely unselfconsciously. The perfection of wisdom are quite strong on this. They speak very strongly about, for example, the stream entrant is not aware of being a stream entrant. That's why he's a stream entrant. Doesn't regard it as any kind of personal attainment in that way, as a sort of badge, as a sort of, you know, as feathers to adorn himself with and strut around in. That's completely antithetical to, you know, the Dharma life. It's much more, I think, any kind of serious attainment. Actually, what it leads to is a much stronger sense of the need for greater purification and transformation, a much stronger sense of faith and devotion. In the Mahayana Sutras, this is brought out by the great Tiantai master. He talks about the highest wisdom practice of 10th stage bodhisattvas. They're right on the cusp of Buddhahood itself. Their highest wisdom practice is to continuously worship all the Buddhas. That's the highest wisdom practice. So on our own level, the reflection of that on our own level, you could say the highest wisdom practice for us is to worship the Buddha. If we really are moving in the direction of the Buddha, if the Buddha really is at the center, well, that actually will result in worship and thanksgiving and gratitude and so on. Not any kind of big I am attainment sort of vibration that can so often go on. But nonetheless, we need to orientate ourselves in this direction. We need to aim for becoming irreversible in our Dharma life, so that under any circumstances we will continue to go for refuge. You know, whatever's going on around us, you know, difficulties in home life, difficulties in life, in the world, difficulties maybe in the Sangha, difficulties within ourselves, you know, an attack of the kleshas, or health, you know, severe, you know, terrible health problems, the threat of the loss of the body, death even, the prospect of death. We continue to go for refuge. Our going for refuge becomes unconditioned, not dependent on conditions and circumstances. That's well worth reflecting, how conditional our Dharma life is. And when I say conditional, I don't just mean, you know, all the conditions that are around us, including the effort to meditate and practice ethics and so on, but conditions in terms of, you know, having a body, having money, having a home, having loved ones, all that kind of thing. To carry on practicing in the face of all that, you know, being taken away, being threatened, well, that's a sign that you're getting somewhere. That's a sign that there's real progress. Whatever's going on, you keep going for refuge. And this is symbolized by the private ordination in our ordination. So we need to aim for wisdom. But how? How do we do this? How do we get to this wisdom? I think sometimes wisdom can be talked about in a way that it's over there. You know, it's this great attainment. And in a sense, from a certain point of view, that's true. Wisdom in the sense of a direct, unconditioned seeing, unmediated seeing into the way things are, you know, unsupported by any kind of conceptual framework, just as it is. Well, that's, you know, quite something, that direct vision, you know, that direct knowing, that direct tasting. But there's a lead up to it. There's a training that you go through with wisdom. I've used quite a lot here the metaphor of seeing with wisdom. And that's used a lot. The metaphors for seeing are things like the Buddha uses the expression the eye. Aimichi means in his case the Buddha eye, or there's the Dharma eye. So it's a very, very powerful image that the eye of truth is open. So it's directly using that metaphor of sight, or a very clear picture. Aloka can mean this. The word for light can mean a very clear picture. Or we talk about gaining a perspective on things. We have it just in the ordinary parlance, don't we? When we really understand something, we say, "I see," and that's to convey, "Well, I get it. I really get what's." I see it. There's something in the metaphor of sight that is really direct, isn't it? So it's no surprise that the metaphor of seeing is used for prajna. But in some ways, like all metaphors, it's got its downside. I think a lot of the metaphors to do with wisdom are kind of cognitive. They're, and they can be. For us in the West in particular, I think they can get caught up with thinking that we're seeing directly, when actually we've just got really knowledge about it. And I think that sometimes we're not able to distinguish between direct seeing and what is really a conceptual construction. And you can see that sometimes when people claim that they've really seen, and then, of course, they go off the rails. I've met many people who've told me that they were enlightened, or that they'd become an irreversible bodhisattva on a retreat, only to find that they just leave the Dharma. You know, so it's the big experience, the wow experience, isn't necessarily an indicator of really seeing and knowing. So it's interesting to look at the metaphor that's used in the training for wisdom. It's not seeing, it's listening. It's hearing. I think this is very interesting. The first level of prajna in Buddhist tradition is known as Shuddhamaya prajna, the wisdom that comes through hearing. Shuddha is hearing, listening. Very interesting. It's usually translated as learning. But it literally means hearing, because of course in the Buddha's day, you know, spiritual knowledge, all knowledge, was transmitted orally. There weren't books. If you wanted to learn, you had to go and hear. You had to go and listen. You had to go and sit at the feet of a master, of a teacher, and you needed to really open up and listen. Hearing, I think, really is connotes as well tremendous receptivity. I think it is, as a metaphor, the metaphor of the ear and hearing is a more receptive mode, I think, than seeing. There's something about seeing that kind of goes out, doesn't it? You know, when we look at things, which, you know, it's more sort of active in a sense as a metaphor. Whereas hearing, I think, has more the quality of receptivity. It's more in a sense, not passive, but, it's coming in. A very good friend of mine, an older member named Archera, who lives in Sheffield, one of the things he does, he's a coach for big businessmen. And, you know, he said, what I really want to do is to get them to meditate, you know, but they don't want to do that. So I have to be quite careful how I approach that. So, and one of the things these big guys in, you know, running businesses, they're not very good at receptivity. They're not very good at listening, actually. And that can often cause problems in business. So he said, I give them a little exercise. Spend a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes in your office, just listening. Just listening to the sounds in the room outside. I thought that's very clever. You know, that's that, you know, it didn't give it any kind of moral value. Just stop and listen. You know, if you have trouble doing nothing, it's very good to as a sort of intermediary to that, is to just listen. Just sit and listen. Sangharakshita once told me when I was asking him about what his morning meditation was years ago, when he was going through a period of doing quite a lot of morning sitting, he said, I often start off just listening to the sounds of the traffic outside and the bird song, and then I might really focus on the incense burning, really concentrate on smell. But listening, and I said, but then what happens? Oh, well, too much to say, you know. You know, it's quite interesting. But that, very much that receptive mode, listening, hearing. So wisdom in the Buddhist tradition begins with hearing. But the word shruta, it's not just a matter of turning up sort of, all right, well, let's go down to the Buddha and, you know, we'll turn up and just, you know, listen in on his talk. Shruta in the tradition also has a sense of, this isn't the right word, but, you know, it comes back to our discussion of reverence. It has authority. Not it's authoritarian, but it has real weight for you because you've decided that this man is your teacher. You've checked him out. You have a feeling for him. You've observed him. And it has a kind of, there's a reverence for him. So his words have real weight and meaning. So it's not just, you know, the listening with the literal ear, you're listening with the heart. You know, that it really, really want it to go in and really touch you deeply. So this is how wisdom begins. Indeed, the name for a wise man in ancient India, and the Buddha used it, is Bahushruta, one who has heard much. One who has heard much. Not one who's studied much, not one who's learned a lot. They've heard much. They've sat with the teacher and they've heard what he said and they've taken it into their heart. They've learnt it by heart. They've made it part of their heart. Ananda was known as Bahushruta because he'd heard much. And, you know, there's this story that Ananda recalled everything that the Buddha had taught. He'd heard much. So there's all that wisdom, if you like, in there. And it's a living wisdom because it's endowed with reverence. It's endowed with faith. It's endowed with emotion. I do love this idiom that we have in English. I don't know if you have it in other languages. Learning by heart. Learning by heart. Yeah, it's a lovely idiom that we have. Learning by heart. It's something that's gone out of fashion. Learning by heart. It's sort of... We don't want to. I'm not going to do that. I'm not into learning parrot fashion. But learning by heart means that poem or that teaching is in your heart. It's a part of you. You take it with you. It's not in your Kindle. It's actually in there. It's inside you. And that's it's beginning when it's inside you. That's the beginning of wisdom. And I think I would recommend that you learn by heart. At least some of the Buddha's teachings. Doesn't have to be pages and pages and pages. Like, you know, Dada Rinpoche, for example, would know pages of text. He would have just been able to have said them. And he'd know the exact verse, exactly where it was, without looking at where it was. He'd just know that was, you know, because he was taught in that tradition from a tiny lad. Well, we can't do that. But you can take some phrases and learn them by heart. I remember the great contemporary cultural critic, George Steiner, the great and marvellous literary critic and all aspects of culture, George Steiner. He said that he was very grateful for being taught in the old French lycée system, where you had to learn pages of Greek and Latin text by rote. You just had to have it in you, and if you didn't, you get beaten. And he said, you know, he wasn't suggesting that we bring that back. And I'm not suggesting we do this on Going for Refuge retreats, that you learn reams of the Pali Canon. If you don't get it, you're going to be beaten. I'd get beaten if I tried that one. But he said what it did, what he was grateful for, was that he felt that all that culture, all that poetry, all that literature, philosophy, had given him ballast in the storms of life. There was something he could refer to. The wisdom of the ages was sort of inside him. So that when really difficult things were going on, he had something, he had a kind of compass, if you like, to change the metaphor, from all that culture inside him. Now, I think we can do that with the Dharma. And it need only be just a verse of the Dhammapada, or even half a verse of the Dhammapada, that you have by heart, and you take it everywhere. You take it everywhere, and you, if you're standing by the bus stop, or you're going on the train, or you're travelling somewhere, you've got that in you. You know, even if it's just one verse of the Dhammapada, even that verse, hatred never ceases through hatred, it only ceases through love. This is an eternal truth. That would be a wonderful thing to have by heart. And when you have it by heart, you can reflect. You can go into it. You can meditate on it, which brings us to the next of the wisdoms, the next progression of wisdom. Just say a little bit more, though, about Shrutamaya Prajna, the wisdom that comes through hearing. I think when you have a teacher, when you have a tradition that you're involved with, and you really are receptive to that, you take things in. One of the things that can happen to you is that, if you take that seriously, is that you can come up against wonderful conflicts which can generate more wisdom. You sometimes see this going on within the lives of great teachers. The Buddha says this here. He says what seems to be the opposite there. Are both true? Was the Buddha mistaken there? Was the Buddha right there? What's true? You see this in different texts. Sangharakshita certainly had this experience, and not just to do with the teaching, but to do with actual experience. Like, for example, he was around in his very early wandering days. He'd completely gone forth. He sat with some Hindu teachers, very great Hindu teachers, not very well-known ones, I don't think, in this day and age. But there was a teacher named Swami Ram Das, who was a very, very kind and compassionate man. And they were talking one day about love and compassion. And Swami Ram Das was saying, love can kill. Compassion can even take life. And this really threw Sangharakshita into a real internal conflict, because he really respected Swami Ram Das. He was an immensely kind and compassionate man. And he was saying this. And, the Buddhist tradition says, that taking life is always unskillful. He didn't say how he resolved the dilemma. But what I found interesting was that it created that tension in his being. Another one, which perhaps we can gain a bit more of an understanding about, is after he's written about this in a book called 43 Years Ago, he discovered that when he had his bhikshu ordination, that the very respected Thai monk who ordained him was not celibate. In fact, what he thought was the woman who looked after him in his vihara was actually effectively his wife, and all the children were his. And that had a huge effect on him as a young monk when he discovered this. And the fruit, and then, you can see him working out what does this mean? And he even came to the conclusion that this man was a good Buddhist but a bad monk. A good Buddhist but a bad monk. And this was one of the routes that led him to the discovery that of the centrality of going for refuge. That there was, in a sense, something sort of wrong in some aspects of the Buddhist tradition because of their privileging of the bhikshu ordination over the act of going for refuge. It's very, very interesting, that particular experience, that particular conflict, and he was a very, very traditional monk in those days, Sankaracharya, led to a much deeper realization of the truth of the Dharma. So sometimes you can find this in your practice. You know, somebody will, you know, you might even be reading Sankaracharya, and you'll see, well, hang on, how does that weigh up with that? You even see it in the life of the order. In the early days, you know, sometimes some order members, you get this phrase, you know, because Sankaracharya has, at regular intervals, has redefined the order right from the early days. You know, in the very early days, it was redefined almost daily or every week. Somebody would come and see Sankaracharya and they'd come back and say, Bhante's saying this. And we'd say, what? Wow! What does that mean? You know, next week it would be something else, you know, and, you know, and you're kind of, you know, in a tizzy because it's a dynamic community. It's still happening. You know, and, you know, recently there are these different papers that have come out and you get this is the order I join. This is not the order I join. Well, of course it isn't the order you join. It's always changing. That's life. That's what happens. It's always undergoing a transformation. But sometimes these things that are said, and if your teacher is a really positive, don't like this word authority at all, but has this, you have a reverence for them, they have weight for you, you are going to have to go deeper into your understanding of the Dharma. Much more deeper into what are the meanings of these teachings? What are they really pointing to? What is each teaching pointing to? So this leads us to the second aspect of prajna, the chinta maya prajna, as it's called. This is the wisdom of chinta is really directed thinking. It's the wisdom that comes through really thinking upon, pondering upon, contemplating what you've heard. You go over it and over it and over it. And you're doing that within the context of meditation and ethics and spiritual friendship and study groups. A study group really is a collective contemplation, a collective directed thinking and exploration of the Dharma that we've heard, of the wisdom that we've heard. But you're making it, you're really weighing it within your experience. Well, perhaps there's different ways of going into it. Perhaps the first level, you're seeding your experience with the Dharma that you've heard. It's, you know, you're regularly turning it over in your mind. I've talked about you learn it by heart, but then you've got to keep going over it almost like a mantra. This is why you have the little sayings and maxims in the Dharma. This is why you have the different lists so that you can actually seed your mind so it goes deeper and deeper into you. There's a lot to be said for just regularly repeating a teaching over and over again in your mind. That's what you need to do. Or you look at it from different angles. You know, you look at it in different ways, from different points of view. You compare it with other teachings. You see how it relates to your experience. You see the implications of it. But in one way or another, you're regularly reflecting upon these Dharmic truths that you have in your mind, you have in your consciousness. You're weighing them, going over them again and yet again and again. I think Ratnaguna has written a very good book on reflection, if you want to get more of an idea of this Chintamaya Prajna. And I did a little bit of work on it in a little booklet called Listening, Reflecting and Meditating, which I think they're both in the bookshop. I just looked at the different ways in which I reflected upon the Dharma, how I did it, how I approached it. And I think there are many different ways of doing it. But in one way or another, you're trying to internalize the Dharma more and more. And I think when this starts to happen, and if you're doing this with real emotion, feeling, concentration, direction within the context of a total Dharma life, you will start seeing more deeply. In a way, things will start flashing at you from you know, in life experience or in the texts themselves. You know, and this is how, if you like, wisdom in the direct and fullest sense begins to kind of come through. Sankaracharya describes a very interesting process when he's on retreat in South India in an ashram, again, before he's ordained. He describes how he was spending his time reading and rereading the middle 50 discourses, the middle length sayings, and how he was really trying to understand the Four Noble Truths, the Three Lakshanas, conditioned co-production, and those basic teachings. He said he just went over them again and again and again. And he said he'd used the veranda of this ashram as a sort of ambulatory, where he'd walk up and down, just turning over what he'd been reading. You know, turning it over in his mind, really trying to see into what these different teachings were actually saying. You know, what were they trying to communicate? And then he said at night, doing his mindfulness of breathing, doing his meditation, he said he'd have flashes of insight into, you know, direct experience of what these teachings were actually pointing to. So a very good description of the three kinds of wisdom. And we can have similar moments. We can have similar moments. It might not be the, you know, wisdom in the fullest sense that's impressing itself upon us. But have you ever had those times where suddenly a teaching becomes really alive for you? Really alive. It might be in a talk, somebody just says a phrase and suddenly you're electrified. It's not just to do with them saying it. It's also to do with your, you know, it's not just to do with your receptivity, but you've been doing some work as well, probably. And it just really gets through. And suddenly you sort of know it in that instant. That might fade, that knowing, that sort of direct knowing, but it's there. Something's happened. Something's happened to you, that recognition. It happens a lot in the Buddha's life. You know, he says something. And because the person is really prepared, they're not just receptive, but they're in ferment, sort of with their life or with the Dharma, because they're in ferment. It's like alchemy, I guess. That, you know, that magic element has gone in and they know, they see in that moment. So we have this. You probably all had it. Think about it. You might not recognize it as that, but you probably had it. I can think of the times when it sort of happened to me. As interestingly enough, in India, I remember, and it was to do with the Dhammapada. I remember a couple of things, I guess, and it was a talk by Sangharakshita before he came. This was in the late '70s when he first came out, when we'd first started there, and Lokamitra and I was tagging along with Lokamitra, trying to help with setting up our Sangha there. And we had a lovely little Sangha of Mitras that we'd started, all very happily being together. This was in Pune, where we started. And as sometimes happens, you know, in India, somebody suddenly died. One of the Mitras, he just died. You know, he had got a fever, and that was it. He died. No explanation. And it was, you know, very upsetting for our Sangha. You know, it was just this tragedy in his family as well. I remember going to his funeral, and it's the first time I'd seen a dead body. It was the first time I'd seen a body on a pyre. Incredible atmosphere there. Actually, something quite, in a sense, liberating in the atmosphere, but also the terrible grief of his family, because the terrible loss. But also, you know, he was the one working to support this young family, and, you know, no social security in India. Very, very tragic for all of us and for them. And when Sangharakshita came out, sometime later, he did what's known as we had a Punyana Modena ceremony for our Mitra, our friend, Mr. Wagmare, his name was. And, a Punyana Modena is where you rejoice in the merits of the person. There's a food offering to, you know, the Sangha, to Sangharakshita and the order members, and, you know, the merits are dedicated to Mr. Wagmare, and money is raised to give to the family and things like that. It's a very, very positive occasion. And Sangharakshita at that time, I mean, I'd read the Dhammapada, but in those days, because I was sort of, you know, I thought, you know, the Tantra was the thing, you know, that was the real teaching. I hadn't really paid the Dhammapada much attention. Foolish me, not realizing, of course, the Dhammapada has the highest possible teachings imaginable in the entire realm of Buddhist tradition and, you know, world literature, the real wisdom teachings. And Sangharakshita gave a talk on that verse, which he says is actually very difficult to translate. Those who know that we are all heading for death will compose their quarrels. Those who know that we're all heading for death will compose their quarrels. And I don't read this verse, but I'd never heard it. And it really impressed me. It really impressed me. I thought, that's amazing. And Sangha actually gave this very simple but very, very good talk on this. And I found myself reflecting on it a lot, this particular verse. And I thought, I know that the Buddha is enlightened because of this verse. I know it. Anybody who can say this with such elegance and simplicity, to have all that truth and wisdom there, they must be enlightened. So it gave me a lot of faith in the Buddha. And also this elegant, simple truth, bringing together the fact of our mortality, the fact of impermanence, the fact of death, and love, metta, harmony. You know, to bring those two together in that direct way, that direct seeing, that direct knowing, that's got to be the truth. You know, and, it really brings me up short, you know, when I'm in conflict or something like that, to go back to that verse, to keep saying it to myself. It's a bit, you know, but there was at times with that verse, just knowing this is true. This is real. This is the way to be. This is what a wise man does. This is how a wise man behaves. He doesn't get into quarreling. He practices metta. Because he knows that we are all heading for death. You know, and I remember Sangharakshita's exposition. He said, you know, somebody dies and you're in conflict with them. What can you do? You can't resolve it with them. Okay, you might be able to do work within yourself and all the rest of it, but not with them. Certainly not in this life. Who knows in the future? Just very direct, very beautiful. That was one thing. Another thing was, it was to do with Gampopa, but it was a Dhammapada-like verse, again in India. When I first went to India, I got tremendously homesick. Very, very nostalgic for my childhood in Sussex. Nostalgic for rain. Nostalgic for bland food. Nostalgic for the football results on Saturday afternoon, reading toast in the cosy lounge. I was so culture-shocked by this weird world I was in called India, with death on the streets and disease outside the door and poverty just up the road and, you know, just all this sunshine that was never ending. And I got very nostalgic for my parents and, you know, my childhood home. Not for my Dharma friends in India. It was all for England, Sussex. And I was reading Gampopa. Why I thought that would help, I don't know. On going for refuge. And, Gampopa says something like, quotes a verse, a Dhammapada-like verse. Well, I think it is from the Dhammapada, ultimately, the Sanskrit one. You must know that your family and homeland are not a refuge. You must know that your family and homeland are not a refuge, not a source of security, not a sanctuary. And it was true. In that moment, it was absolutely true. And I didn't want it to be true. And I burst into tears at this terrible truth. It was true. This is not a refuge for you. It is not a place that you can go to. And when I came back to England, so looking forward to going to my, you know, where I was brought up, the happy fields of Sussex, it wasn't a refuge. England wasn't a refuge. When I came back to England, I thought, is there a state funeral? Seems so dead, so weird, so... You know, something happened. Everybody seems, anyway. So there wasn't a refuge. You know, it was. So these verses, I'm sure you've got your own, and occasionally they hit you. If you're reflecting on the Dharma, they will touch you. You will see into them. Follow them up if they touch you. Keep reflecting on them. Turn them into an actual living experience, which brings us to the next of the prajñas. The Bhavana Maya Prajna. Sometimes it's translated the wisdom that comes through meditation. Bhavana, meaning meditation. But Herbert Gunter translates it, the wisdom of making it a living experience, which I think is much better. It's not just to do with meditating. Yes, you know, and we mustn't think that wisdom just happens in meditation. Meditation is extraordinarily important. But when I think of wisdom-like moments, and I say wisdom-like, because I've got doubts about whether it's really transcendental wisdom, but wisdom-like moments, by and large, they haven't happened in meditation. By and large, they've happened outside of meditation, in the context of a life of meditation, or attempt to meditate, attempt to be ethical, a life of devotion and serving the Dharma and all the rest of it. But they've been in, you know, they've been in the living experience. Wisdom is a behavior. We must remember this. It's not just to do with seeing. It's to do with acting and living. In the Perfection of Wisdom, they talk about the prajna paramita charya, the living out, the living of the perfection of wisdom. This is what the Bodhisattva does. He's the life of wisdom. So we need to be living a wise life. Wisdom needs to come into, well, not just into being. It's not just understanding into being. It's into behavior. It's into becoming. It's very important. Our ordination is called the Dharmachari ordination. The Dharma living ordination. A Dharmachari shouldn't be really interested in attainment. They should be interested in the living of the Dharma in all they do. Well, not just interested in it, actually doing it. Bringing the Dharma, bringing wisdom into every single aspect of life. And of course, that's how the mandala becomes transformed, through that living, through that behavior. And you can see it in that Dhammapada verse, can't you? Those who know that we're all headed for death will compose their quarrels, will end their quarrels. So that's a behavior. That's the life of wisdom, the life of seeing into the truth of things. Yes, so we need to bring wisdom into our life, into our behavior. Wise acting, wise action. What is that story? I think Sangharakshita quotes it. It's from the old Hasidic tradition of Eastern Europe, you know, where one of these great rabbi mystics goes to see another rabbi, and he came back and they said, what did you do? He said, I watched the way he tied his shoes. That's what I learnt. You know, it wasn't to do with, you know, the expositions of the Torah or the Talmud or the Kabbalah or whatever it was. It was how he tied his shoes. The wisdom was in the tying of the shoes. Something like that. So it's wisdom in behavior, in life, in action, in what we do. It's this charya. So what can we say about that? The life of wisdom, the living of wisdom. Well, I want to sort of take a sort of, step sort of sideways from this and move into a slightly different place. Well, perhaps into a different place, perhaps not at all. I'm going to talk about somebody who I think lives wisdom. I'm going to talk about Sangharakshita, my teacher, in terms of the sort of living of wisdom. First of all, again on that trip to India, talking about those moments of seeing more clearly into things. A story I've told before, but I don't mind telling it again. When Bhante came out to India at that time, the atmosphere was incredible. It was his first visit back to India since he'd started the movement here in England. And we had all these incredible... I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen a lecture to, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people. With Sangharakshita speaking, it being translated into Marathi, and beforehand, the refuges and precepts chanted by all those people. And, in India, of course, when before a Dharma talk, there's lots of garlanding, beautiful, particularly these marigolds, these French marigolds that we have, the brilliant orange ones, the little ones. Loads and loads of marigold garlanding and things like this. Tremendous atmosphere. So there was a real atmosphere of devotion, a real, that kind of mood everywhere. And there were all sorts of experiences that I had with Sangharakshita where I really learnt some things about life. One of them was after a talk, and I was his sort of Batman, I suppose, you know, in the sense, you know, not in the, well, you know, in the military sense. I was his attendant, so I'd get his sandals on his feet when we'd come off the stage and gather up the garlands, and we'd go through the crowds to a car that would take us home. And there were all these people who wanted to touch Bhante's feet. Especially old people, especially very poor people, men and women, they wanted to come and touch his feet, to take, have his blessing, to take his darshan. You know, that's, they wanted that connection. They wanted that, you still have that in India, that very strong sense that direct contact with a teacher, with a guru, if you like, with a wise man, does something for you. And I was trying to keep people away because it was a real, you know, it was a real crush. And Bhante just very firmly, very kindly, just put his hand on my shoulder, said, "You mustn't do that. It's very important to let people express themselves in this way." And he said it was such tenderness and compassion, both for me and for the people. I don't think he was particularly interested in the hero worship or anything like that. But he could see that, well, these people were being treated as untouchables, as outcasts. And I was perpetuating that in my ignorance, wanting to protect Sangharakshita. But no, this contact is important. So there was a real wisdom in that action. It was wise action. It was very elegant action, actually. And I learnt something. I learnt something about human communication in that moment. And I don't know if it was on the same evening when we were back at our little place where we were living. I used to put up his mosquito net every evening and make him his evening hot milk or something like that. And I really enjoyed serving Bhante in this way. And I was overcome with emotion. You know, it was just so incredible. The devotional mood was so strong. And I wanted to express this to Bhante. And I said, "Bhante, I don't know what I will do when you die," or something like that. And he just turned to me and he looked with this very direct glance. He said, "That's assuming I'll die first." And it was a real Vajra strike, you know, and all sorts of things kind of kicked off in me and things like this. You know, what an assumption that he was going to die before me and all that sort of thing. So, again, it was an action. It was a communication. It was something living and live. And this is when you're with spiritual friends and, you know, you're living that kind of intensity, this is what can happen. When you have that kind of openness, I guess, that engagement with spiritual friends. It doesn't have to be with a great teacher like Bhante around. It can happen between us, but the Dharma can come alive. It can live. It can enter into our behavior very, very powerfully. But I mentioned that word elegance. I find that very interesting, that there was something very beautiful in that moment when Bhante touched me. And, you know, that the there was great beauty in his compassionate and kindly words to me about, you know, his feeling for the people he was with. And so when we first got Pabaloka in 1976, Sangharakshita, well, living the life of wisdom, the Charya, the Dharmacharya, perhaps even the Bodhisattvacharya, what did he do? There was a 3-week summer retreat. This was June 76, the long hot summer of 76. What did he do? He taught the Dharma. He did 3 seminars, you know, for about 30 people, one after the other in the same retreat. First on the Arya Pariyasana Sutta about the life of the Buddha. Secondly on the perfection of wisdom, the verses of the accumulation of precious qualities. And finally on meeting spiritual friends from Gampopa. Just pouring out the Dharma. After that retreat, for the rest of the autumn, he was just doing seminars here. And when you went on a seminar with Sangharakshita in those days, he was a younger man. You did about, I think you did about 4 or 5 hours study a day. Not just a little discussion group, but 4 or 5 hours. sitting down with him, expounding and unfolding a text, and just complete energy spreading the Dharma. Really getting it across to us, really engaging with us, answering our questions, even challenging us, and at times utterly delighting us. And on that first seminar that he did, and by the way, the seminars took place in the retreat centre lounge in that corner, just inside the double doors, just on the left if you go on. So if you want to know where one of the PowerPoints at Padmaloka is, Sangharakshita would have been an armchair there. Another PowerPoint is the tea counter. Surita had his public ordination in front of the tea counter. There wasn't a tea counter then, it was a big shrine. So there's lots of PowerPoints in, I don't mean electric PowerPoints, I mean, you know what I mean. But anyway, in this, I want to just mention, just to close, as usual, I'm going on a lot longer than Dharmadipa. The guys making the tea were quite shocked at how short Dharmadipa's talks. They weren't ready to make the tea because they're so used to me doing them, and I go on and on. Anyway, come on, Dharmavajra, get it together. Anyway, in this seminar on, I want to talk about what he said about the perfection of wisdom. He's really trying to get across to people what the perfection of wisdom really is, away from the highly conceptualized Indian metaphysic, even saying that in some ways the Indian metaphysical way of, highly conceptual way of talking about things, it's not really suited to Buddhism from a certain point of view. It's not concrete enough. It's not living enough. It's not live enough. So he tried to approach this, and he approached it through metta. Well, first of all, he talked about vidya and prajna, and particularly Herbert Gunter's translation of these terms. And he uses the word aesthetic to describe vidya and prajna. He talks about wisdom as an aesthetic appreciation. Aesthetic appreciation. Wisdom as aesthetic appreciation. Sangharakshita really picked up on this. And I think it sort of related to even notions of Indian aesthetics. He said, this quality of aesthetic appreciation is more like a relishing of things and people. You get this in Indian aesthetics. They talk about arasa, taste, flavour, savouring, relishing. You're really tuned up, totally tuned up to everybody around you, to everything around you. There's no sort of barriers between you and what's out there. And you get to that through a true aesthetic appreciation. Not aesthetics in the very precious sense. Not aestheticism in that sense. But something much more down to earth. He talked about it as a non-utilitarian relationship with people and things. You see the person, you see the thing, not in terms of their use for you, you see them as they are in themselves. As they are in themselves. With real appreciation. If you're seeing them as they are in themselves, you're seeing them as, and with metta, you do this through seeing them as beautiful, you're not seeing them with craving. You're not seeing them as something for you. So that you're not seeing them with a self and with another. You're not in the subject-object framework in that moment. That is wisdom. Incredible thought, I think. When you purify the mind of seeing people and things in terms of use, when you purify the mind of that craving, that grasping, what you can get from them, what you can get from that thing, what you can get from those people. You see them as they are in themselves, see them with beauty, you're getting close to wisdom. And he said that is how a bodhisattva operates. A bodhisattva is in that space all the time. A bodhisattva charya, therefore, is also known as the anubhoga charya, the way of delight, even the spontaneous way, the way of spontaneous delight. That's why they talk about the bodhisattva's play. All the work that the Bodhisattva does to communicate the Dharma, to set up environments in which people can practice the Dharma, all that different thing, all those different very practical things that a Bodhisattva has to do takes place. What Sangharakshita calls a small circle or mandala or sphere of utility takes place in a vast mandala of aesthetic appreciation. A vast mandala of aesthetic appreciation. That's the greater mandala. Basically, the Bodhisattva's perspective, vision of life is fundamentally aesthetic. He doesn't see people as things, he sees them as growing and living beings, forces, if you like. It's interesting, isn't it, that when the Buddha talks about his vision of all living beings that elicits, that brings forth the great compassion, the great love, it's a vision of beauty. He sees all living beings as being like lotuses, red and blue and white, emerging out of the swamps. He sees them as beautiful. He sees them as emerging with all that energy, if you like, from out of the darkness. And his love, his compassion, is not because they're suffering, in a sense. It's because he wants to bring forth that abundance, that beauty. That's his wisdom. His wisdom is his compassion. His wisdom is his metta. His wisdom is the creation of this mandala, this harmonious world in which all living beings and all human beings can live as they should live for the Dharma, live as growing beings. That's what to enter the greater mandala really means. So when we talk about wisdom, we must talk about it, we must think about it perhaps more in this way. Wisdom is an activity. Wisdom is acharya. It's living the life. Living the life based on seeing others as they really are, as growing and living beings that can grow even unto, yes, Buddhahood itself. And we do all the work we can to create that greater mandala that, well, everybody can live in. So I'll stop there at last, and over to Paramabandhu.